Welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steve.
Today we're going to be talking about one of our favorite childhood stories, The Chronicles of Narnia. Chronicles of Narnia is one of those series of books that holds a really special place in my heart, a tender place. When I was 7 or 8, I saved up all of my paper route money, and these were the first set of books that I actually purchased completely on my own, using my own hard-earned money. There was a Scholastic book fair, and there I was, 7 books in front of me, and I just knew I needed to have The Chronicles of Narnia. So from a very young age, getting right into fantasy. So in a lot of ways, they were my first foyer into book buying and the world of speculative fiction. So a tender place for these books. Everything that I say comes from a place of love when I criticize these books harshly for the next period of time.
My first book was Jumanji, I think. That was my first Scholastic book order.
Hey, to each their own, right?
That's the difference between us right there.
Narnia is... well, I mean, the books were published in the 50s, the 1950s, by C.S. Clive Staples Lewis. His name is a complete sentence. It's published in the 1950s, and C.S. Lewis was an ardent Christian. I think he famous for his fights with J.R.R. Tolkien, for Tolkien not being Christian enough, or the right Christian for C.S. Lewis. I think they ended their friendship over it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Christians have been resting on the laurels of their three Oxbridge forebears for a long time, I think. Because it was C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, and G.K. Chesterton was actually the third part of their trio. You know, and they were kind of articulate, high colonial British guys, stood against the rising tides of modern thinking. Oh, what? Quite right.
And I mean, I don't know for sure, but it feels like C.S. Lewis was maybe even more the most conservative of the three.
He may well have been. It's hard to know. G.K. Chesterton might have him there, but it's hard to tell exactly what he's up to with some of his stuff. G.K. Chesterton would like comment about like anarchism and communism and stuff like these, and he would reference them, but it's not completely clear what he's up to with some of it.
Did G.K. Chesterton, did he do a lot of fiction writing?
Yeah, he wrote, well, again, he wrote allegories in much the way that C.S. Lewis did. So his most famous one is called The Man Who Was Thursday. And so it's about this like policeman who's joining this group of anarchists to find the head anarchist Sunday. So they're all in the dark days of the week, and as they go, like so, and he becomes Thursday, and so him and the six other anarchists, and as the book progresses, they find out they're all actually policemen, and Sunday is God. So, you know, oh, sorry, spoilers alert. For any of you who haven't read The Man Who Was Thursday, a 60-year-old novella.
I really like that. So, The Chronicles of Narnia, as Stephen sort of alluded to, are heavily allegorical. They are just chock full of Christianity, Christian references. You've got Aslan, who is...
I'm surprised you can't go into Christian bookstores and buy a little stone table, like, to hang around your neck.
That's true. Though, I mean, now that you mention Christian bookstores, there was a BBC version of Chronicles of Narnia, and I remember seeing it on TV when I was... quite young, and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was a pretty good...
I have them on DVD if you want to go down memory lane.
I also have them on DVD, and the only place when I was probably 15 or 16 that I could find to buy Chronicles of Narnia, the BBC, on DVD was a Christian bookstore. No other place had them. Maybe the internet did, but this was in the early days of the internet, before Amazon...
destroyed all the Christian bookstores with their satanic warehouse. Also, they destroyed all bookstores, but anyway.
Well, before we get too sidetracked about Amazon, which is easy to... So the allegory is there, but it's interesting that the first, I don't know, 7 times that I read Chronicles of Narnia, I didn't pick up on the Christianity. I didn't... All of this allegory just kind of flew over my head, and I just read them as a fun... romp through time and space by these kids who were, you know, of a similar age to me. And I was like, I could be one of those people. I could find a Narnia. Just let me get to the back of these wardrobes and I'm going to find my own. And, you know, it came up the other day on Twitter. There was Alexandra Rowland, I think, was the account, and she was talking about nostalgia and understanding of stories and sort of the a long, long time ago, the understanding that we have of like a prior place and a simpler time. And Narnia for me was definitely like a simpler time. And then when you're an adult and you go back and you read it, and as she says, who stuffed all this Jesus stuff in here behind my back? Because I read them probably again when I was in college, and I went, holy moly, these are just... Wow.
Lion equal Jesus? What?
Yeah. You mean, wait, when he was killed on a stone table and rose again 3 days later?
Who knew?
Who knew?
Who knew?
And interestingly, some of the books can actually be read as sort of like an allegory about nostalgia itself. It gets kind of like a meta-nostalgia, where C.S. Lewis is talking about going to Narnia and... Susan, after their first trip to Narnia, doesn't get to go back to Narnia because she's too old and she's too skeptical.
Too interested in makeup and boys. And Peter also can't come back, I don't think. Can he?
I don't think that they ever discuss Peter going back, but there's a definite point made about Lucy trying to get Susan to come back and Susan not being interested. And even when they get her to the wardrobe, she can't enter Narnia.
And forgetting it. Like, oh, that was just silly stories, like not even believing it herself.
Yeah. So it's sort of this idea that when you're young, you can believe these things. They're real for you. But when you get too old and you have adult interests, you lose the ability to even have these stories or to experience these things. And then, I mean, I think then you have the last battle and things go a little bit weird. There's a lot in that book that I think I probably still don't understand. I mean, it is the Book of Revelations, so I don't think anybody can really understand it.
Monkey wearing a lion skin, you know.
There's a lot of weird things happening. And that really talks about the nostalgia and the meta nostalgia. And this place is only here to teach you about another more fundamental truth. Narnia was never really Narnia. Narnia was just the skin on top of the real Narnia. And the Chronicles of Narnia are just a skin on top of teaching you about the Bible and about Christianity. And so it's kind of this meta narrative about the books themselves and about your understanding. And I think by the time you read The Last Battle, you're supposed to kind of have an idea that, oh yeah, these are about being Christian, and now I understand that, and I can let the books go and get into the more fundamental truths.
Yeah, and I think The Last Battle is really where C.S. Lewis starts to show his particular theological idiosyncrasies, I think. But it's also couched and so opaque, it's weird. C.S. Lewis really internalized this whole thing about like universality of Christianity. That, like, Christianity was everywhere, like, in, like, basically I said, like, oh, you can go to a completely different magical world, and Christianity is there. The Christ narrative is unfolding there. You know, God is completely transcendental in a totally metaphysical, permeable sense. It's the anti-Golden Compass, or maybe Golden Compass is the anti-Narnia. I don't know. But, yeah, just that God is completely metaphysically permeable. And C.S. Lewis actually really took this forward in, like, you know, like, when he read in, like, Mere Christianity and stuff. About all other religions are actually just other people's botched attempts at Christianity. Everything is Christianity. Christianity always arises. Christianity always finds a way to exist in all contexts at all time. And it all links back to this one big universal. Like at the end, there's the world and it's all split off and they're all connecting to this one point. And that's heaven. And so there's sort of multiplicity of God. And so there's a cosmopolitanism. I think that actually a lot of particularly Orthodox Christian or really conservative Christians today would actually be really horrified. Not C.S. Lewis holding those viewpoints, but they don't even understand it when they read him, which I think is interesting, actually, because certainly growing up in like evangelical American Christian right kind of environment, you know, he was like, oh, this is the smart man's Christianity. Not everyone's ready for this, but this is the smart man's Christianity. This guy went to the Oxford. He's oh boy. I think a lot of people actually in the laity would be actually very upset if they understood the weird places C.S. Lewis went with his interpretation of Christianity. But it's hard-baked right in there into Narnia. But it's still also really fucked up. Like, it's also not a great permissive, like, oh, Christianity is universal and all religions have value. It's like, no, all other religions are just some bastardized version of our true religion, so we can pejoratively accept and appreciate them. And it's also a colonial mindset as well.
It seems like there's a few things in these books that C.S. Lewis sort of wants to harken back to the good times of the British Empire and that colonial sort of mindset that, well, we got it right and the rest of the world are savages. And that's not only just with Christianity saying, well, Buddhism is an attempt at Christianity and it was a good try, but we'll give them the real thing. In a sense, the four children entering Narnia is an act of
conquest
and colonialism on its own.
The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is a story about four British kids who show up and say, why aren't I running this place? And are by the end of it.
I mean, I don't know that they ever say, why aren't I running this place? But from the very beginning, in a more almost perverse way, everyone says to them, why aren't you running this place?
Yeah, that's good.
Four British kids show up and are filled with wonder at this magical land that has lampposts growing out of as a tree and animals that can speak. And all of the animals are saying, save us, you're our only hope.
Give us peace, order, and good government.
Yes, and eventually the children sort of accept this mantle, and miraculously Narnia enters a golden age run when these four children who have, you know, no real experience governing.
Or real education,
before whatever grammar school they have. They lead Narnia better than it has ever been led before.
You, Mr. Tumnus, will be the head judge, and you will be responsible for establishing tort in civil matters between dryads and beavers and whatnots.
And I don't know that it's the only colonial sort of narrative. There's The Horse and His Boy is sort of an interesting story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, when we went to do this, I started thinking about the Narnia books, and I kind of realized each one is kind of a weird knockoff of another kind of book, like another writer, you know. And so like, you kind of read The Horse and His Boy, and The Horse and His Boy is kind of like a Kim, you know, like Rudyard Kipling's Kim. Like, it's about this, like, Kim is about a low caste boy in India who ends up helping the British army, but it's a story about this Kolormin slave boy who's, I think he is Narnian, right? He's taken from Narnia at some point.
Archenland,
but yeah. But anyway, yeah. And so the Archenland and the Narnian army defeat the Kolormins, then saves Lucy or Susan from being forced to marry this, you know, Ottoman sheik. Anyway, it's very
Rabadash.
Interesting. Rabadash, yeah. Anyway, so there's, it's all like a very Edward Said type Orientalism kind of just put into that book. And you learn a little bit more about the geopolitics of Narnia a little bit, and there's kind of this stand-in Muslim polity to the south of Narnia, and there's all this intrigue around it.
It's also one of the things that I didn't think about too much when I was a kid, and raises too many questions now that I'm an adult. So to the south of Narnia, there's two nations, Kalorman, Archenland, or Archenland, I'm not sure how to pronounce that exactly, both populated by humans, Kalorman being, sort of an Ottoman Empire-type place. And
it does not respect talking animals.
Yes, talking animals are slaughtered, I think, if they're found. They're just killed. And they also don't have butter. Weird.
It's a religion thing. They don't know the lion unless we do.
and then there's also Archenland, which is an ally of Narnia, also populated by humans. I don't know, seems to know the lion better. I guess for me, this starts to beg the question. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the first book, we're told that only sons of Adam and daughters of Eve can rule Narnia and break the eternal winter. What was wrong with the people from Archenland or Kalorman? Why did neither of these nations step in?
Not white.
Well, Archenland is white, though. That's the weird part, right? Like,
well, we learn, I mean, the thing we learn in Prince Caspian is that actually after that, some humans do come to Narnia on an island.
Yeah.
Yeah. So actually there's people that come to Narnia. There's humans trickling into Narnia actually all the time.
During the same time apparently that the four British children are establishing their monarchy in Narnia.
Their massive fief.
Archenland is also being populated and is established with its own dynasty, with complete with naming traditions for the twins that I guess are incredibly common within that dynastic family, because
don't think about it.
Find out at the end of Horse and His Boy, the slave boy should have been called Kor, and his brother was Corin, and they were princes, and his name is Kor because he was born just first out of the twins. So they have the same name, but one is shorter than the other, so you know which one is set to inherit the throne.
It's from whatever civilization they came through. Anyway, we're not getting into this.
There's some questions for me. Some questions that I never thought about when I was younger. I just accepted them. But the geopolitical story of this, these nations sort of fighting against each other, because Calormen wants to invade Narnia, because right now High King Peter is engaged in a battle with the giants on the northern border of Narnia, so it's the opportune time to sneak in the back of Narnia and conquer it.
It really solidifies Narnia as a world power.
Yeah, certainly.
And to the point where they also dictate, like, they, you know, if Calormen cannot expand its borders without Narnia's direct permission. And really sets him up as hegemon on the continent. And also, then we learn in Prince Caspian, Voyage of the Dawn Treader, really, is that also during this time, like there are actually naval explorations and Narnian colonies established, like, on the high seas, on islands and other continents, for whatever that's worth. The lords of Narnia go out, and the Lonely Islands is established as a Narnian colony.
Yeah.
Weird.
And fantastic. I still love the books, and I think I could still read them and enjoy them.
Getting back to this whole theory that all of the Narnia books are knockoffs of other things of literature, like, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader is certainly, like, a Gulliver's Travel type narrative. The Last Battle is kind of, like, almost an Aldous Huxley sort of narrative.
Prince Caspian is, I don't know what it's a knockoff of, but... It's a story of civil war in Narnia, or at least at the very least civil unrest and humans getting too big for their britches. But then a young humble prince being able to
a young mama's boy kicked out of his house, gets help from Aslan to become a real man and kill his uncle.
Yeah, and unify the people, that he was humble and he went and he sought the help from the animals, and they recognized that, you know, he didn't mean them any harm, and so he gained their respect. And
he restores Kar Paravel as the capital.
And Narnia is again saved and led back into a golden age. You just need a good human to unify these people. The animals, you know, they were upset, but they didn't have that unifying force that would actually lead them out of the darkness into...
Mm-hmm. It taught me that just because I was a sissy's mama's boy didn't mean I needed to give up on my ambition of ruling the world.
So. You just needed to find Jesus.
Or just be of the right blood. Just have the right dad.
Or find Jesus.
But call him A. But call B.
Your dad's a good guy.
And one day his empire will be mine. Big takeaways for Narnia, for me, I think, is that, it's 20th century British culture kind of really distilled down, actually, I think, into these little pulpy novels. And as much as I might rag on C.S. Lewis, and I might be dismissive of I think, how people have pinned accolades to him as being an intellectual giant beyond what he probably was, I do think he is an excellent writer. You know, and he communicates ideas very well, and he's very articulate. And again, and in terms of doing these kind of style parodies of dominant forces in English literature, he does them masterfully. And as much as I try not to do criticism or, you know, say whether I like things or don't think like things, I think it really is kind of the story of being a young settler child in British colonialism, and I think that is us. That's who we are.
Yeah.
It's going to resonate for us. But it's in that once it also reinforces some of the most terrible and destructive missionizing and imperialist impulses in us. And I think the thing I'm learning is it's learning to survive the tensions that produces, and understanding that only by knowing it can you really address it. I think.
Yeah, I think they're still really great books to read and to encourage children to read. They are kind of pulpy, but they're good reads. They're fun reads. But then it is good to, you know, have these discussions about the books and not just sort of accept them, not just accept the allegorical lessons in the books as being the truth, or to just glaze over the allegorical lessons and not address them at all.
Yeah, and realizing, I think, that there's nuggets in there, as much as it kind of gets written off as just this, there's actually kind of nuggets of, like, resistance in there. Like, there's contradictions that exist kind of within it, which are interesting and kind of fun to leverage against other things. Because, again, C.S. Lewis, I think, has kind of been co-opted by one particular model of Christianity. Is kind of there, like, and I don't think he really fits. Like, I don't think a lot of these Christian right people, you know, think, who view C.S. Lewis as, like, the sort of, like, very high-minded and articulate spokesperson for their brand of personal relationship with Jesus, really actually represents that when you dig down into it. So there is some extent to which C.S. Lewis's legacy can maybe be liberated from some of its Christian righty connotations as well.
So that's our take on C.S. Lewis and the Chronicles of Narnia, books that we really love. Recognize that there's maybe some issues with them, but maybe not as many issues as people would like to attribute. Thanks for listening again this week. You can find us on iTunes or on Google Play. We'd really love if you could take a minute, go give us a rating, and leave a review. Any of your feedback is really appreciated. You can also find us on Twitter at AssetDroid.
Send us a raven.
Send us a raven. Thanks again for listening. Music this episode, as always, was provided by An Ant and an Atom, and we really appreciate the continued support.